we will open the Senate Revenue Committee for March 14th. Time is just flying by. The order we're going to go today is, first we're going to look at a bill from our sixth committee member, Senator Morse, who has kind of set up shop with, which we appreciate, with this committee, and is helping us work through Oregon's fiscal structure. We're going to do Senate Bill 470 first, and then following 470, we'll look at the whole senior property deferral issue and hear from, I think, the department, Paul, or and I've introduced the bill on behalf of the constituent. I don't know if Mr. Devine is here, but I've certainly contacted me many, many times and have introduced a bill on his behalf, and we'll look at that bill, too. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 470. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your material today, there's a outline for a staff measure summary, but if you turn the other side of that page, I have one of my charts again on looking at the Senate Bill 470 proposal compared to some others that that have either been considered or are now being considered and current law. Senate Bill 470 is, of course, a statutory spending limit. What it does is it sets a limit each biennium, and that limit must be set by March 31st of each regular session year. And it is determined by, although not limited to, but determined by over the revenue forecast, resident personal income, changes in population and the general price level, and it must consider the Education Stability Fund balance and the impact of voter initiatives. So those are some of the elements that would go into determining the spending limit. The governor would recommend a limit, and then the legislature would approve a spending limit bill by March 31st. If the legislature does not act on the spending limit bill by March 31st, any other bill that passes after that time would be declared void under Senate Bill 470. The subject limit is general fund and lottery proceeds. The exception is that, or basically must be explained and outlined in that spending limit bill. And then if revenue is in excess of the limit by the end of the biennium, that excess will be deposited in the Education Stability Fund. The other proposals there, current law, of course, 291.357, which replaced the appropriation growth limit in 2001, uses personal income as a target. Its subject is governmental activities, which is much broader than general fund and lottery, but it does exclude business enterprises, such as OLCC, for example, fiduciary activities, such as PERS and other reserve fund accounting. Federal funds is excluded, donations and bond proceeds. There is some language for exceptions on ballot measures and emergencies. There is no provision in the current statute for what happens when revenue exceeds the limit. The other proposal I have there is LC-10, which was prepared by the Interim House Revenue Committee, and the final version of that was in May of 2004. It's a constitutional limit that sets a base based on, at that time, it was based a little over $12 billion. And the amount from that base is then allowed to grow 8.1% per biennium. The revenue that, or the expenditures out of revenue would be general fund, lottery, and then any revenue from a new tax. There's a 3/5 exception process, and excess revenue would go into a surplus, into a general reserve fund, and then once that fund is filled up, it would go back out as the 2% surplus kicker refund. The other proposal I have there is Initiative Petition 6. This is currently in circulation, and Don McIntyre is a primary proponent of that. What it does is sum a population change and inflation over the prior 2 years, similar to the Colorado limit. It defines state government disbursements as the target, or the what's subject to the limit, and it excludes federal funds, bond proceeds, and donations, and any contributions to reserve funds. The exception process there requires a 2/3 vote in both chambers. Plus, if there's a two-thirds vote approval, then that measure would go on the general election ballot for a majority vote of the public to exceed the limit for one biennium. There is no, unlike Measure 8, which Mr. McIntyre had on the ballot in 2000, there is no provision for surplus revenue. So if revenue exceeds what the limit is, it just can't be spent under the Constitution if this were to be approved by the people.
So that one seems more strict to me than even Colorado's taper law.
Mr. Chair, the mechanics are similar in the sense that you have the population and inflation change that will limit you. You're either limited by the revenue you have or by the spending limit, one or the other, and then it's a rate of change. So you have what's called a ratcheting effect that we had earlier in our appropriation growth limit. But on the other hand, it doesn't have some of the other elements of the Colorado table. For example, they have a refund process. So if revenue exceeds what the limit is, then there's a refund process in which taxes are refunded back to the taxpayers. This doesn't have a provision like that in it.
Mm-hmm. And, Paul, do you know, I know we'll get into this with Senator Morse and Senator Schrader, but do you know on the March 31st that of any state that has that type of deadline set, where no bills would be void after that deadline. Do we have a model for that?
I don't know of one, Mr. Chair. Senator Morse may, but I don't know of that kind of a deadline process.
Good morning.
Good morning. You ready to go?
Please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, for the record, Frank Morse, State Senator from District 8, Albany and Corvallis. Again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear before your committee, and this morning with respect to Senate Bill 470. The focus that I have in looking at this issue of spending and revenue is how do we preserve and, in fact, enhance the integrity of representative government? And things that are embedded in the Constitution that are relatively inflexible and would, in fact, vest to a minority of this assembly powers that I don't think are actually healthy. Is a concern to me, and so 470 has arisen out of my interest in making representative government work better and improving the process. I think it would impose upon this body a higher degree of fiscal discipline by improving the process. I think it would make a more open process as we prepare the budget. And then there's a secondary factor, I believe, that would be accomplished over time with 470 as it is played out, and that's educational. That as we prepare the budget and bring them forward, the governor does, that, and as I would like to just walk through the sections of the bill, there's a very real educational component that I think is overlooked currently in our process. So maybe just to go through the bill briefly in summary. Section 1 declares a spending limitation bill, which declares the size of the pie that we have, revenues from general fund and lottery to spend. It would require an appropriations bill that would broadly divide that pie into education, public safety, human services, natural resources, have adjustments for salaries, and then general governmental purposes, which essentially is the discretion of the chairs in their budget. And then it would require the spend limitation bill to be approved and signed by the governor prior to March 31. So early in the session, based on the March forecast, we've set the size of the pie, we've made the broad allocations, we've come to agreement within the assembly as to what our charge is in terms of revenue and appropriations. The bill also requires that we, the assembly, follow some of the same guidelines that the governor would be required to follow. And that is, when he's preparing his budget, and this moves forward to Section 3, that the governor shall consider at least the following. The population of the state as we grow, inflation, personal income, and then, of course, we've had this discussion when we're talking about reserve funds, the financial impacts of unfunded mandates that come either from voters or from federal mandates. And that's an educational component that I think is important to lift up to voters. And as we've discussed previously, currently about a third of our general fund appropriations are driven by unfunded voter initiatives. So looking then at moving forward, we set the sideboards essentially for ways and means subcommittees to go about doing their work, and then if we have from the March forecast to the May forecast and actually have excess revenues more than we have appropriated, then those would go into the Education Stability Fund. In terms of a little bit more specific about what the governor would be required to do, he would, and of course he does now, show the source of total anticipated income, the amount of revenue estimated, and adjusted for amounts to be borrowed, amounts to be realized from any fees or taxes that are projected. And he would then bring forward a spending limitation, and again, considering the population, inflation, personal income, and unfunded mandates. Section 4 is kind of a language improvement where legislative council has felt that existing statutes could be improved. And then in Section 6, it's what I call scenario planning. And any organization, particularly a complex organization, will do scenario planning so that you have made plans for unanticipated changes. And what this does, it would require the governor to prepare what is called an existing level budget plan and then a 90% plan, so that we've made that public, and the governor then would be rather prescriptive in terms of the 10% reduction from in terms of programs and activities that may be undertaken by the government. So, Mr. Chairman, committee members, that is a bit of a summary. But again, my interest is in how do we make representative government work better. I just am fundamentally opposed to caps in the Constitution. I don't think that it will serve us well in the long term. But if we can create a process that has greater discipline here, I think that we can move the ball down the court better than what we have in the past. So, Mr. Chairman, those are my comments, and I invite my colleague as well.
Morning. Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Kurt Schrader, District 20, appreciate the opportunity to testify before you in favor of Senate Bill 470. 470 should look familiar to you all. It is basically the outline of what we've done this particular legislative session, at least as far as the legislative budgeting process has gone on. The goal in 470 is to also include the governor in this process, and I think as Senator Morris indicated, our goal is to make this a very transparent, thoughtful, deliberative budget process where everything's put out on the table early in session. I think that is a recipe for success rather than a recipe for disaster by trying to wait to the last minute and figure out what sort of revenues and what sort of programs, program levels we want to deal with. I will point out one. I think Senator Morris covered the bill very well. There's one aspect that I would have a slightly different interpretation than I thought I heard the chair in his earlier questions of staff, and that's that I believe the details that Senator Morris and I have included in the bill, inflation, population, personal income, those are not meant to be proscriptive. They're inclusive. It's not a formula-driven type of approach. It's things that any citizen would expect the governor or the state legislature to include as they deliberate on this. And however they get to that spending limit in some rational way prior to March 31st, I think is okay. So with that, I just think it's really important that this bill move forward. I'd certainly like to. I think the process that we've done so far this legislative session is hopefully a model for less controversy, less partisanship, and more thoughtfulness in the future. And I would encourage this committee to give it some due consideration. I would like to see it come down to ways and means at one point in time, but you know that's my area of interest and expertise, and I think since this covers that area that would be appropriate if that's okay with the chair.
We'll see on that one. questions for our senators. So, and the question that I had for Paul on the inflation and population was more about Mr. McIntyre's and the prescriptiveness of that versus this proposal.
Right.
So the main question that I come up with on this bill is the March 31st and the argument that that we would be assisting representative democracy, because I think this biennium, actually, I agree, it's a model in terms of getting that kind of the size of the pie out early and getting that defined, though we never, this would have us actually take a vote on it. But I'm thinking back to really tougher years, and you don't have to go back very far, just a couple years. And by setting that March 31st, well, I guess the simple question would be, had we had that in place 3 years ago, would we spend the month of April really doing no bills at all, just defining that? And I'm wondering if that would have been helpful to representative democracy, because I know how the media would have interpreted those deliberations and would have reported those. And just, I guess, would invite your comments on, would we really want to set the 31st and then null and void any bill after the 31st of a legislative session? In times that we lose, especially with the finance structure we have, with the volatility that we have.
Well, I'll give you my impression, and Senator Morris give you his, Mr. Chair. The way I read the bill again, it says enact. So we have not had any bill yet pass the governor's desk, even this legislative session. So I don't think it's meant to preclude the work of the committees, the deliberations of the policy committees in terms of moving the process forward. This is merely, at least from my understanding and the way I'd like to see it play out, a little discipline so that it encourages the leadership and co-chairs and Ways and Means members to get down to business early. We are fortunate that we got down to business earlier even than the bill suggests this past session by coming to this virtually the same agreement, although we didn't get it to the program allocation. Senate did, the House did not quite get there. But we got that done by March 2nd. So I think there's an opportunity here not to hinder the process, but just encourage a little discipline.
And you think even, say that, because the difference is this time in terms of the two chambers was about roughly $100 million, $125 million and so, you think that would be achievable if the differences were, that's my only fear, is that you get down where you have a $900 million difference and you've got that March 31st deadline, which might be healthy, might be helpful to have that kind of hammer there, but I could just see, I guess, worst case scenario, and you might have to amend Senate Bill 470, but worst case scenario would be you would be sitting there mired in what we had in July of August of those long sessions. I guess you would just fast forward it to April, but you'd really have a stalemate because nothing would be occurring.
If I may again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a statutory bill. Therefore, the legislature could certainly pass a resolution or an exception to this bill, notwithstanding for a month or two. We do that in other areas. And so, again, I think if leadership was really, really up against it and having huge problems, there would be an opportunity for them to move that deadline should it be necessary. Hopefully, it wouldn't be done with impunity.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I might make some comments. I don't have the history of previous sessions and the special sessions, but I do have very clear in my mind the experience we had last session. And granted, there are philosophical differences in this building, and those need to be recognized. But the process that we went through last session is what this bill really addresses, is to come to grips with the reality of our revenue structure and make it work and do that early and put discipline in the process. So I just feel like that there's an opportunity here. We you know, I think constitutionally we're obligated to do essentially one thing. I don't think we have to pass policy bills, substantive bills, but we have to do a budget, and it has to be balanced. And, you know, waiting until the last nickel drops and then scrambling to spend it maybe hasn't served us as well in the past, and maybe this process would serve us better.
Senator Stark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for either of you. This committee is looking at reserve fund legislation that might, in fact, pass this time. Would there be a reason to include within this proposal application of those reserve funds to a downturn in their economy as a part of that estimated revenue forecast?
From my standpoint, Chair, members of the committee, I think that's an excellent suggestion. I think marrying up the concepts, I know the Chair has some thoughts about that. I think the committee obviously does, apparently, and I think it makes perfect sense.
And I would agree.
Mm-hmm. And I would agree, too. Senator George.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. These are great steps, needed steps, but there's one major portion of this whole thing missing. What are you going to do about cost containment? How are you going to get expenditure under control? What are we going to do about administrative staffing and the staffing charts that we can't even get our hands on? What are we going to do about the fact that expenditures that we're seeing in state government are out of control? You can't get it by just dealing with the money at the top. You've got to go down and look at each one of those units and make sure that this is a competitive, efficient operation. I don't believe it is. Can you help me understand where are we going to go on that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think Senator George raises some very good points, but that's what the Ways and Means process is supposed to be all about. I'm hoping that this legislative session by settling some of the bigger size of pie and program area allocations, we can actually do that. In the Senate Democrat budget proposal that came out, we're looking at the ESDs in some serious detail, quite frankly. We're looking at how our healthcare delivery systems are put together. Is there a way to block grant things with the counties or other partners to avoid increased administrative cuts out of our limited streams of revenue? We're looking very closely at attorney general costs. We're looking at, I mean, across the board. So I think your admonition is well taken, and hopefully that is the responsibility of the co-chairs, the Ways and Means people, to try and do as good a job as possible.
I would concur. One of the things that happens when you have a downturn in revenue is, most often, is you have a reduction in services. And the one thing that tends to get overlooked in this process is how do we bring costs in line with what Senator George is suggesting, and how do we create greater efficiencies. I would suggest to you that this bill would, in fact, put greater emphasis on the role of Ways and Means. Once you've determined the size of the pie, like we have right now, what's agreed to does not meet the program requirements that we've set by public policy, substantive policy initiatives in the state. It doesn't do it. It doesn't get the job done. So it's incumbent upon Ways and Means, that with even greater emphasis, to figure out how in the world are we going to preserve those services and create the efficiencies. And so I've got faith. I think the Ways and Means process can work. It allows, actually, I think, a more lengthy time frame in which to accomplish those things. Once you've set that and you know what you're dealing with, do it early and then go to work and figure out how in the world can we preserve these vital services by reducing costs and becoming more efficient.
Senator Jordan, please.
Thanks. I've come to the conclusion, and now being one of the quote-unquote senior senators around this place, without an investigative arm of the legislative branch, without a significant auditing branch of the of this area, we're not going to get it. The administrative branch is not moving on these areas. They continue to dump budgets on us, and you know they tweaked around the edges a little bit, but basically it's the same old, same old. And they expect us then to fund it. And I'm just wondering your opinion. I mean, we have all sat on Ways and Means, and we've all had these presentations done to us, which are bland, if anything could be even that descriptive. There's no detail in there. There's no analysis. What are you doing, and what are the costs per unit? There's nothing in there like that. And I'm just wondering, could you help us here to understand? Because I think this is only part of an effort. What do you feel about further investigative and auditing powers?
I guess I'm going first for some reason.
I'll defer to seniority.
Thank you so much. Yeah, put my mouth. I did a good job last week. Maybe I do it this week too.
Monday.
Yeah, it's Monday. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think Senator George again raises some outstanding points. He has served on Ways and Means. He knows the trouble we have trying to get what we consider good, accurate information. It's too bad he is not on the committee this time, because I think he'd be very pleased with the tenor of the discussion and with this performance-based budgeting system we're doing. We are actually making these agencies and our educational partners to come to the table with ideas about what they think are our outcomes. Furthermore, we're not just saying and rubber stamping those. We are actually changing those, challenging them, I think hopefully in a constructive manner to say, hey, you know, what are we getting for the dollar? We are looking at per unit cost. Maybe an agency is doing extremely well in terms of some of its investigative work, but it's costing us too much per unit. I mean, that should be looked at. We're starting to actually dig down and get those as the main issues that these agencies will be presenting to us. Some agencies have been unprepared to present that to us this session. We've not heard their budgets.
Mm-hmm.
Economic development barely got its budget through phase one because of the paucity of information that it brought forward. There's a couple others that will go unnamed, but they're very clear if you look at whose budget's been heard and whose have not that are of major consequence. We're holding their feet to the fire on these things. So, like Senator Moore said, I'm optimistic that as we work through this new process, and it probably will take several biennia, I'm not going to pretend we're going to, you know, weed it all out this particular session. But with you helping make sure we do that, Senator George, I think we have a great chance of getting further than we've ever done before.
Thank you. Let me ask the other side of that coin. Senator Morris, on the front page of the bill, in Section 1, it lists off the four main areas, A through D, lines 13 through 16. And you've done a pretty good job of educating this assembly in terms of, has spending actually increased in education, senior services, natural resources, or has it been an initiative process and other transfers that have been outside, by and large, this building's jurisdiction that have increased in terms of the last decade and now decade and a half? And so are we in some ways misguiding the public when we enact legislation like Senate Bill 470 and by telling them in some ways that the four areas actually are increasing and are increasing a great deal when I hark back to the chart that you presented this committee about 2 weeks ago that was very, very illustrative in terms of, no, there has not been an increase in those four key areas that comprise about 94% of the state budget.
Mr. Chairman, I think you raise a good point. Accountability cuts both ways. And we need to be thoughtful about these discussions. When voters initiate things, there are consequences. There are fiscal consequences. And they need to be held accountable and educated with respect to what those consequences are. That's one of the things that this bill would do, is it would elevate in every budget cycle. Said, folks, this is where we've been, what we've done, and these are the consequences. Now, how we deal with those, that's our accountability and how we manage around those. But I think that there's been a paucity of information with respect to what has been the cumulative impact in the decade of the 90s with respect to what voters have said for us to do. And then they say, well, you're not accountable. Well, it cuts both ways. And I think this bill will help clarify that, and certainly a degree of education for us as well as the public.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Further questions for our senators? I have just one last question. It's at the end of the bill in Section 6, just the scenario planning and having the governor submit a 90% budget. I don't think, just reading the Section 2B, you would just have the governor present the 90% budget to the legislature just for our consideration, but no actual vote or adoption of that 90% budget, just so that we knew if revenues decline, this is roughly where the governor would make the cuts.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The chief executive officer of any organization sets the agenda. It starts there. And by doing the scenario planning, you have a way of then getting a jump start when things head south. And this, the attempt at this is to do that planning so that you so you can deal with it thoughtfully and at least have your chief executive officer making some recommendations. That's all he would be. If we have this scenario, then this is what he's recommending, or she may be recommending.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up, if I may, members of the committee. We actually do this right now in one form. While the governor submits his governor's recommended budget based on the December forecast, he also includes 10% reduction options, which would be the logical thing we go to. So this really is not a lot different, if you will, than what we currently do.
And I might just elaborate, Mr. Chair. It would go beyond that because you're talking about programmatic issues. You have the 10% reductions within agencies, but comparative across the board between agencies and between programs, what is the most thoughtful way to manage a 90% budget? And that's what this would address as well. So it just adds another component.
Thank you very much. We'll reserve a seat on Tuesdays and Wednesdays for you to join our... thank you for your work. Anyone else on Senate Bill 470, or are we going to move right to property tax deferral? No one else. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 470. And open a hearing on Senate Bill 478, and we're going to take a brief look at our whole senior property tax deferral system and then look at any issues that we might need to consider for legislation, if any. Mary.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 478 changes the annual interest rate imposed on amounts deferred by qualified senior citizens under the provisions of the Homestead Property Tax Program, Disabled Deferral Program, or the Special Assessment Program. The interest rate will change from a fixed 6% to the primary discount rate on January 1st for the year in which the interest is being accrued. It also applies to interest accruing on or after January 1, 2006. Give you some background on this particular the deferral program. Current law will impose the 6% rate on property taxes of qualified seniors who defer their payments on these liabilities. Qualified seniors must have an annual household income that cannot exceed $32,000 as of 2003, indexed annually to the Consumer Price Index. When qualified seniors defer their taxes, the state pays them to the counties, and in fiscal year 2003-04, the outstanding balance for deferred taxes for about 9,000 qualified seniors who were participating, it totaled about $122.95 million, as reported by the Department of Revenue in one of its recent reports. And we've also reported it as such in our public finance tax for the LRO's public finance tax for fiscal year 2005-07. Since 93-94, cash flow of repayments of previously deferred taxes with accrued interest, which I call inflow, has been partially offset by the state's payments to counties. The cash balances have been between $6 to $9 million each year. For example, in 03-04, cash flow inflow totaled about $22.6 million, of which $6.6 million was accrued interest. The cash outflow was about $13.8 million, resulting in a positive cash balance of about $8.8 million. For 04-05, the Department of Revenue projects cash balance to be about $9.4 million. That's at this current 6% interest rate. The current 6% fixed interest rate imposed on deferrals is the price of borrowing money for qualified seniors. The proposed variable primary discount rate of the discount window program of the U.S. Federal Reserve System is currently 3.5%. As I said, it's a variable rate. This rate varied between 0.75% and 6% over the past year, 8 years, with an average rate of about 3.8%. And based on current fiscal year forecasts of the prime interest rate, which is a different interest rate, it's the rate that banks charge their best commercial customers. And this rate has been forecasted by the Department of Administrative Services. Taking that prime rate and based on its historical relationship between the prime and the discount rate, which has been about a 3.5 percentage point spread, okay, I'd say it's unlikely that the discount rate will exceed 6% by the end of 07-09. The forecast for the prime rate, which is the higher of the two, is forecasted to be about almost 9% by the end of that biennium. So
we're certain that
it's going to go up.
It's going up.
Yes. If that relationship, the spread on average is about 3.5 percentage points between the prime and the discount rate, historically, over the last 8 years, monthly.
Huh.
So, anyway, what I did is I took the spread and I used that to really construct the numbers for the discount rates for the next two bienniums based on the prime rates forecast. And based on that, I came up with a revenue impact for 05-07 of minus $2.7 million and $2.49 million in 07-09. These are impacts on interest with no behavioral changes. You'll see that 07-09 number is slightly less than 05-07 because down below in my assumptions, you'll see that the forecast for the prime is going to go up. So the forecast for the discount rate should approach 6% by the end of the biennium, which means that the differential between the current rate of 6% and the rate at the discount rate won't be that big in 07-09, right? So I can't have as big an impact there,
mm-hmm.
right? So that I just wanted you to sort of alert. I wanted to alert y'all to the fact that Southern National.
Oh, I like you. Y'all's good.
Well, I was in the South for 15 years, so. But I wanted to alert you to the other impacts that are associated with this change. I can't guarantee that they'll happen, but I can say that, you know, we just experienced lower mortgage rates and look at the response to a 50% reduction in mortgage rates over the last 5 years generated a housing boom. So I think a drop from 6% to, let's say, the current discount rate is 3.5%, that's substantial in the financial market. Okay, it may not seem like it is, but it is a big rate in the financial markets. And so I think it will trigger two other types of impacts. And these numbers, the second impacts I've said with estimated behavioral change, maybe just simply illustrative at the present time. It's not a hard fixed number. But assuming the interest rates move in the direction I've predicted with the spread between the discount rate and the prime rate, we could expect that the current 9,000 seniors who are currently in the process of, let's say, repaying their interest and previous liabilities, some of them may defer longer. So one impact is that the deferral period will lengthen out. And I tried to incorporate that by using what percentage, a smaller percentage of that group that might have paid this year will defer for another year. Eventually, you know, you'll get the money and the repayments with interest, but suppose they defer. That means that that little illustration I gave you earlier about the cash inflow and the cash outflow, that dynamic will change. And so if some people that are currently paying decide to defer longer, in addition, assumption three is that some qualified seniors, say another 9,000 seniors out there who are paying their taxes now, decide that their spread is such that it might be beneficial not to pay them for a few years. So you've got two groups of people, those who are paying who might decide to defer longer, and those who are currently paying their taxes but might decide to begin to defer. And when you put that together into a scenario, the numbers get substantially larger, okay, for the two biennium. And if you go back to my previous example where I said I gave you the example about cash inflow for 03-04 and 04-05, and I'm not talking about general fund here, but you all know how that relates to general fund ultimately. But if the amount paid to cities and counties, you know, is less than what's being paid in, plus you get interest, then you've got annually about an 8.5% to 9.4% cash flow balance. It's positive. With the scenario I'm presenting on the revenue impacts for the analysis that incorporates behavioral changes, you might wipe out that cash balance. And so you've got nothing, you know, it's sort of just a whatever you started out with at the beginning of the year and the senior deferral fund, that's what you might end up with. And I think these estimates are relatively conservative. Mm-hmm. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Mary. Questions for Mary?
Question.
Please.
We're in the South.
Florida.
Northern Florida.
Northern Florida. Yeah, it couldn't have been Southern Florida.
No. More towards Georgia.
Yeah.
Y'all want to continue outside where it feels like Florida? Or,
you know, Georgia or y'all is that. Good. Y'all. It's a very inclusive word.
That's true.
A lot better than you guys.
For you all.
Perfect, sir.
Okay, so the department, do y'all want to come up and give us a 5 or 10 minute overview of
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips. I'm with the Department of Revenue. We just have a brief, some brief statements. We're asked to talk a little bit about the inflow and the outflow of money into this revolving account. Norm Miller is with me. He manages and supervises that program. The handout you have covers some of the things Mary mentioned, so I won't cover that. But just in a few bullet points, we want to talk about the inflows and outflows. We want to talk about the debt that the account owes to the general fund. We want to talk about some revenue projections for that fund. And just to remind the committee that this program was the first of its kind in the nation and back in the 1960s. And there are 24 other states that have followed suit and have a similar such program. So it's been becoming popular. There is an amount that we'll talk about in more detail that's owed to the general fund of the state. And it was money that was advanced from this body to get that program off the ground and running. The program works generally, as Mary said, that the taxes are paid by the state of Oregon to each county. So none of the local governments forego, like an exemption, none of them forego the revenue. We pay the money. And so there's this huge drop, you'll notice, when we go to the charts, every year in November, there's a huge drop in the balance. And that's where the money's going. And finally, since the revolving account was established back in the 80s, the fund has been self-funding. In other words, there's been no more general fund appropriations since the 80s. There are about 8,500 program participants. The second page, or the last half of the first page, I should say, I'm just going to pass over. There are variables to all these projections and issues that have already been partly raised. So we'll skip over that and go to the third page, which is a graph that tracks some distinct periods of time and three different factors. The periods of time that run from the top to the bottom in columns are the phases of the program, starting with the initial section up to about 1982-83. And this is where the general fund advanced monies to this program to get it going. The second phase is where the revolving account funded the program. And in the third phase, that's where the Department of Revenue has been paying back over time through reversions to the general fund to pay back the debt from the original advances. The last column in the dotted section is the projection area. The three lines are monies in, monies out, and fund balance. So you'll see that the monies out from 1977 to roughly 90 were on a pretty straight-up curve here, not straight-up, but increasing. And that's about the time Measure 5 came into play. And taxes were going up, deferral amounts were going up, participation was up. As Measure 5 kicked in and taxes started to decrease, the number drops and then flattens out pretty much. The monies in are the repayments. And, of course, in the initial years, people were signing up for the program, and then the things that generate a repayment are, one, the senior or disabled person sells their property, two, they refinance, or three, they pass on, and the property lien is paid off through the closing of the property. So the money's in. Now, they crossed in about 91, 92, and the program started to actually have more money in than was going out, and they're running a little parallel right now. The fund balance is the third line that has the highest peak, and the sharp drops in the fund balance are from some of the reversions that have taken place, which we'll go into next. You'll notice, though, that after the final dotted line to the immediate right of that is the low point, and that's targeted as May of this year, when $27.7 million will be reverted from that fund into the general fund.
Is that because low interest rates, or?
That's because that's what the budget calls for. Yeah. Some amounts, and we'll talk about them specifically, were reverted back in 2003 for that funding crisis. So I think what we'll do is talk a little bit more about what happens with the balance in that account. And Norm, if you want to take over with the next page.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Norm Miller, Department of Revenue. I manage the senior deferral programs along with the timber tax program.
That's right.
So what I'd like to do is continue on with John's conversation. So if you're on page 4, then if you look at that chart, here's all the numbers behind the chart that you saw previously. So I want to address column 2, 3, or 4. Those are the numbers that are on the chart. But I thought it might be a little better to explain kind of the inflow, outflow, and the repayment of what the Department of Revenue has put back in. There's actually, the law provides for two different ways that money has been allocated to this program. Prior to 1985, money was given to the program as an advance. The intention was that money was to be paid back to the general fund. Beginning in 1985, then, that money is deemed as an appropriation, and the law does not provide for that money to be paid back to the general fund. I think, this is speculation, but I think what was happening there, they were seeing that the money going out was much greater than the money coming in, so they had to figure out a way to put seed money into the program to have it, to make it self-sustaining, which it has been since the early 90s. It has sustained itself. So if you look at, let's call them column 5 and column 6, column 5 being the fund advance. Money went out early in the life of this program, and then if you go down into where there are negative numbers that are bracketed, those are the monies that have been repaid then to the general fund and the timing of those repayments. In the last 6 years, then there have been some fairly large chunks of money have come back to the general fund from the program. Right now, let's move on down to where, excuse me, I've gone through a voice changing experience the last 4 or 5 days too. Getting down to where it says repayment of deferral program operating funds to the general fund, the balance as of January 31st of 2005, we owed almost $51 million then of, call that principal. Interest is calculated at the same rate as interest is paid by the people who are in the program. So it's 6% simple interest paid by them. We pay 6% simple interest. Those are linked together. We currently owe just under $16 million worth of interest. So far, the payments that we've made have pretty much covered the interest and have yet to really hit the principal since about 1985. What I wanted to do then, with the balance being about $66 million, what I wanted to do then is show you, since there is a $27 million payment being made toward the end of this biennium, show you the impact of that because it will be significant. First thing I would like you to do, though, is so we're going to go down into the next section. It says balance as of June 30th of 05, where it says $50 million. Cross that number out. Where it says balance owed $50 million, cross that number out. The actual numbers for both of those boxes then are $35,053,337. Excuse me, 3905333. You want to do that one more time?
That'd be great.
3905333. I apologize for the error in that.
Just $4 million.
Yeah, it's.
Jump change.
Of course, if you want to give it to me. So that's kind of where the program stands right now financially.
And just as a side note to that, as Norm's turning the page, that interest accrues at the exact same interest rate as it accrues for the seniors. So the 6%, if it's changed, will also create a different rate for the repayment amount. And starting in June, that interest will start accruing again.
Move on to the next chart. What we're trying to show here is how money comes in more on a monthly basis for these programs. Give you some feel for the timing issues that we might be dealing with. The beginning balance that we have calculated would be about $12,700,000 then, starting June of 05. We'll continue to collect taxpayer repayments, so they're repaying their loan, say, back to the Department of Revenue. In November of every year, as John stated, we make a major payment then to the counties for these property taxes, so the balance goes down, and then it begins to accrue again until the following November. One of the things that you'll see as you go through documents, I'm sure you'll get this year, you'll probably see the ending balance more than you'll see those minimum balances. So the ending projected balance for this particular biennium, the 05-07 biennium, is $24,850,000. That's the number you'll see. But we will actually get down to about $12 million in doing that. I think it's pretty obvious to point out that currently money is accruing into this account over time, even with the repayments. So we're in a building mode in terms of the balance. What's really happened in the last 3 or 4 years with this account is because interest rates are low, because the mortgage rates are low, a lot of people have been refinancing their houses. So it's important to understand that we have a lien against this house. Usually we're in second position to any mortgage that's there. When the people have refinanced their loans then, the bank doesn't want to be in second position, so they make the people pay off their liens to the Department of Revenue, puts the bank back into first position, and then they'll come back in and apply for the deferral program. So really we've had a lot of repayments in the last 3 or 4 years, which has significantly impacted the balances that we're dealing with.
So is the fund managed by statute? If any transfers, obviously any appropriations into the fund, I would guess, would be statutory, but does the department have any discretion with activities within the fund?
Chair Deckard, yes we do. Really what the statute says is that the department will determine when there are excess funds and then repay those to the general fund. So they do have discretion over that money. Really in the past, two legislative sessions at least, it's been the legislature that is, you know, we've looked at the fund kind of together and seen that the money is there, it could be repaid back to the general fund, and so it's happened.
And with some certainty that mortgage interest rates are going to go up, can we say that with just absolute certainty that they're going up? We just don't know how high. What will be the effect on the fund in the next 5 years?
Mr. Chair, I think if you look at the graph, this is really our projection. Since the interest rates are going up, the mortgage rates are going up, we don't feel there'll be as many people that are repaying their loans. So that's part of we'll go back into the mode that we were into when mortgage rates were up. We won't have quite the number of repayments. We took a look just to get some feel for what might happen, a little longer term, and we saw that when you get out into with some of the projections that we've made, and these are strictly projections, that when you get out into the era of 2012, you might see these two funds, the money going in, money going out, come together again, because you're getting into a time when you have more baby boomers that are eligible for the program. We made the assumption that some of those people, at a similar rate that we have right now, will get into the program. So we'll have more people into the program and fewer same number of repayments, actually. So it brings the two together.
In addition to that, one of the other variables mentioned earlier in the documents that we didn't cover was the fact that when the disabled program came in 2001, we weren't sure how many participants we'd have. There was no baseline. So we're learning a little bit about that participation level. The difference between the disabled program and the senior deferral program is seniors, by definition, will be on the program for potentially shorter, longer period of time. They have to be a certain age in order to qualify. Disabled individuals that are low income can be on the program from their 20s or 30s, and potentially we have seniors that have been on the program over 23 years, and disabled participants could, you could see a 50-year participation. We don't know. There's no age limit, so that would increase the time between the start of the program and the repayment. So that would also play a factor.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make one more point then. If you go back to the chart on page 2 and take a look at the money in part of it, with the taxpayer repayments, you'll see that I'm not sure the volatile is the right word for it, but they do go up and down. And it's hard to predict, or it has been over time hard to predict, where exactly those payments are going to be in any given biennium. So one of the things that one of the recommendations that I would make to the legislature then is that we consider kind of a minimum balance for this program. I think you're going to see some opportunities then to pay money out for different things as you go on. But I'd like to my recommendation then is that we create a minimum balance for this program so we can take care of the variations that happen over time. So this program really continues to be a self-funding program, so we don't have to come back to the legislature. Because one of the things the statute also says, it's very clear, is that if we get to the point where we have to make payments to the counties and the balance isn't big enough to make those payments to the county, then they will come out of the general fund. So this way, if we can keep a balance, and the balance that we suggest is a low balance when you look at the chart on page 5, then I put in the recommended balance of about $5 million. And we think that will take care of the variation that's occurred over time.
If y'all want to draw up an amendment to that, that's something I think we could entertain as to Senate Bill 478.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's our presentation on sort of the inflows and outflows. If you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them. We also have comments on the bill itself, if you're interested in that.
Please. Okay. There are questions just on these sheets while they prepare their testimony on the bill. Fire away.
Okay, on the bill itself, it seems clear, at least at first reading, that the interest that the bill suggests, the bill suggests, is the primary discount rate. So it goes from 6% to the primary discount rate, and we assume that when you read that, it just looks like it's the same level of interest. The 6% is the simple interest. We charge simple interest. Simple interest is pretty significantly different than compound interest. Well, when you go on to lines 14 through 16 in the first page of the bill, it defines what the primary discount rate is. And the primary discount rate is pretty specifically defined. And at the federal level, that's a compound rate. So I'm not really sure. I guess somebody smarter than us would have to determine, like, maybe what the legal impact of that is. Which one is it? Because it is pretty significantly different. The 6% is set. Seniors applying for the program know what the rate will be into the future, unless, of course, changed by law. But it's not a floating rate, in other words. It's been that way since the inception of the program. Most programs that we deal with use a simple interest rate for income tax purposes, for timber tax purposes, and for this program. So every year when the interest is calculated, it's 6% multiplied times the outstanding tax balance, not multiplied times the balance and multiplied by the outstanding interest. We deal with a lot of seniors who for them, and this is nothing disparaging on that, but it's easier to understand a simple interest rate and to explain, for our people to explain, who talk to seniors every day about this is a big decision. Should I ask for a lien to be placed on my house? And what is this going to cost me? And what will this do to my potential inheritance for my children? What am I giving away? And they can sit down there and they can calculate it. We have a little better feel for what taxes are going to be every year, because now under Measure 50 they only grow at 3% unless there's a major construction occurs. So you have an idea what your taxes will be. You can multiply that times the flat 6% simple interest, and it's pretty certain. And finally, as I mentioned earlier, this is the same rate then. If the statute is changed according to this Senate Bill 478, then that will change the rate at which we pay back to the general fund the amount of money that's owed on the advanced payments. There are three other bills this session, which I've just detailed there. And then Norm has a couple of examples too that will hopefully illustrate a little bit of the difference between the simple versus the compound interest on a real live case that we have.
I thought it'd be easier to understand if you saw the numbers actually in front of you on the difference between simple interest, compound interest. So what I did is in the first example then is to use things just the way they are right now. So I went into our system and pulled out an account at random and said, here's the taxes that we've paid on this particular account over time. It is 6% interest, and I've showed you what the interest is then. The total bottom line then is about $60,479 that will need to be repaid, you know, if that property, say, were to have sold when I pulled this out a couple of weeks ago. So that's example number one. Let me go to the second example then, which shows if this were to have been determined to be compound interest. And what I did is I went in and pulled out the prime rates that have occurred over the same period of time, applied that then to this. And as you see, I'll just go to the bottom line, ends up being about $216,000. So there's a sizable difference between those two. Mm-hmm. The third thing that I thought was worthwhile showing you, and one of the things when we're talking to seniors and comparing, when they say, you know, I'm only getting 1% on my bank account right now, but you're charging me 6%, to try to explain the difference between simple and compound interest. So what I thought I'd do is figure out for this particular example, and this will vary by time a little bit on what it is. It appears that that if we were charging 0.78% compound interest over the same 22-year period, then the bottom line would be very similar to what it was at 6% simple. So kind of a comparable rate then is 0.78% over that time. The next thing I thought I'd do is, you know, when you're dealing with a senior, what opportunity did they then have to invest in something else? And what I did is picked out a 6-month CD. Say they went to their bank and got a 6-month CD, what interest rate then would they be able to earn on that over that same period of time? And as you can see, it's pretty variable. It starts out at about 8%, goes down to a low of just over 1%, and then is on its way up. This in some respects looks like the prime rate. I mean, the timings are a little different on some of these things, but it's a pretty good picture, I think, of how that works. Another point that I think is important, if you're looking down the road, let's say I'm 65 years old and I'm looking to get into the senior program, I want to know the impact on, let's say if I were to die, passing this on to my heirs. And the thing about the 6% simple interest, or having a consistent rate, is that I can project 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, what that amount is going to be. And that seems to be fairly important to people as we go through this process. So I guess I would say that if you have a rate that varies consistently or over time, there are some people that will not like that as much as, you know, if we want to lower the rate, that's fine. But let's see if we can make something consistent for people so they can predict what's happening.
Good point. Very good point. Questions for the panel?
Senator George.
Do you see a need for the bill? Based on that?
Chair Duckard, Senator George, I think if you look at the balance, you can see where in the last 10 years or so, the program looks like it's made money. You know, there may be some opportunity to change the rate. But if you look, you need to look out long term at that particular rate. I really don't have a comment on whether or not there's a need for the bill, but I would like to see it structured differently, yes.
And I'd like to respond to you, Mr. Chair, Senator George. I think if the idea is to get a low rate for seniors, I think we have that. And it's the difference between the six simple. And I think that's the key thing that maybe people don't see. And hopefully we've illustrated some of that today. If you want to lower it even further, that's your policy choice, but just be aware.
Thank you. Other questions or thoughts? Thank you. Appreciate the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else on senior property tax deferral or Senate Bill 478? Jacqueline, do you want to jump in on this? Oh boy.
All right.
Loquacious is the word we Hey, Ralph.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jacqueline Zimmer, and I'm the director of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. And we help seniors find their way to this property tax deferral program, and now we help people with physical disabilities that are 18 to 64 find their way to this program as well. So thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning. Our testimony is basically, in a nutshell, we're opposed to a change in the program at this time. And you've heard some of the reasons, I think, illustrated before us, the simplicity of the program as far as the interest rate and the ability to project what you'll owe, I think, is a bonus for this kind of a program. But let me just run through some other things that are on our mind right now. And one of them is that under the governor's recommended budget, programs for seniors and people with disabilities faces about a $90 million hole in programs cuts and service cuts. And we haven't yet recovered from the $25 million in cuts that we endured last biennium. And one of the things that's troublesome to us about the cuts is that over the last handful of years, I believe that our programs have received $1 million from the Senior Property Tax Deferral Program Fund, the surplus fund, and that was to help restore some cuts to Oregon Project Independence. The rest of the surplus funds in this program have gone back into the general fund, and also just recently $7.7 million went to the Department of Revenue to backfill what I call their cigarette posse, where they sent deputized people and sent them out around the state to capture the unpaid cigarette taxes. And it really, that was a really painful thing for us to watch, because along with that $7.7 million grab, they took $1.1 million in surplus funds from the Elderly Rental Assistance Program. So,
Jacqueline, was that the decision we made or they made?
You're about to make that, Mr. Chair. That'll be on the floor this week. It was made by the Joint Ways and Means Committee a week ago on Friday. There was no public testimony on that particular issue, and as you'll read through your budget bill, you'll see that it doesn't even actually refer to the Senior Property Tax Deferral Fund when it takes the $7.7 million. You'll be told that it's surplus money, and in fact, that is surplus money. It does technically belong to the general fund and the Department of Revenue, but, Mr. Chair, when we have a shortfall in our budget, we don't go to the Department of Revenue and ask them for funds. And I think it's pretty evident that this body has asked us to be creative in finding resources and structural changes that help seniors and people with disabilities as we face these program shortfalls. And what we had in mind last session and again this session was to ask that surplus funds in this particular program be dedicated to the expansion of Oregon Project Independence to help us create, you know, adequate or stable or just some funding for that particular program. And it's becoming more and more of a safety net every year with every reduction that you make. So, Mr. Chair, that bill will be in front of you this week.
You know the bill number on that?
That's House Bill 5068. And there was some comments made on the House floor about the particular action, and you'll find also that it will be difficult to vote against it because the insurance premium for the forest fire policy is also tied into 5068, and so if you're going to vote against it, you'll be voting against paying an insurance premium for $25 million worth of insurance, and this will be a tough summer to not have that particular policy in place. So we're basically, I guess, sort of fed up of watching the surplus funds in these programs go all over the general fund when we see a nexus, and we're constantly told to bring revenue ideas that are actually a nexus to our programs, and we pretty much think this is a pretty good example of a program that helps people stay at home paying for a program that helps people stay at home. So that's why we're pretty interested in this particular program, and we recommend that you not change it. And in my testimony, and this is just some math that we had a little help with, but we're not guaranteeing its veracity here, I should say. We think that if the rate was reduced to 4%, the fund would lose about $3.2 million a biennium, and if it goes down to 2%, you could lose as much as 6.4%. You know, we understand the idea of lowering interest rates and helping people stay in their homes longer and so on and so forth, but we think the 6% simple rate is a terrific idea. Also, the suggestion for amendments that you keep a $5 million balance in there is sort of, I mean, that's a great idea, but also it makes it harder for us to push ahead with the idea of having surplus funds go to our program if actually the first set of surplus funds goes toward
reserve fund.
And then the a balance. So there, I mean, the legislature took, I think, I could be wrong, $24 million out of this program last biennium, and maybe someone's shaking their head, but I seem to remember that $24 million went out and we lost $25 million in services. So this $20 million goes back to the general fund this biennium, the $7.7 million that went the other day. It's kind of disheartening to continue advocating for funding for our programs when they disappear.
All right, Jacqueline, are you finding, certainly the person who introduced this bill, and it's a low interest rate environment, are you finding that widespread, or is this isolated cases of a few folks in a low interest rate environment are saying, I could be doing better? But I don't know how widespread. Mr. Devine is a constituent of mine who has been very vocal about this issue.
Mr. Chairman of this committee, there is one other legislator that has approached us about this particular idea this session and has chosen not to introduce the bill. I think once you understand the simple interest rate and then the fear of watching the interest rates grow, I think it has an impact on the idea of moving forward with it. So one other legislator this session.
So, and from citizens themselves, you're not getting compensated?
Mr. Chair, I have never heard anyone ask to change this in the public, but I don't have as much direct contact with it. And
Department,
then again,
are y'all getting inundated with our numerous vote?
Not inundated, but I think
there's
a question.
Well, you have to. It's either a nod or a or testimony. There's three chairs, Ralph. You.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Norm Miller. We do talk to people daily, and for the most part, what they're saying, they don't understand the 6% rate and how it compares with what they're seeing at the bank. And that's the thing that we need to explain most. There are a few people out there that would like to see the rate lowered, but I'd say the majority just do not understand it, and we try to explain it to them.
Great. Thanks. Question. Ralph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner. I work with AskMe, Council 75. I'd just like to ditto Jacqueline's comments. I have an interest in housing and having a background where we created this legislation, but also Project Independence, not myself, but my committee. And I really like the idea of the correlation between surplus funds above a minimum amount. That makes some sense. Going into Project Independence, and the reason for that is what we discovered when we did the homework on Project Independence and spent a year traveling the state was, as a matter of fact, Ron Wyden and some of those folks were our staff on that committee. That shows my age, Mr. Chair, but the fact is we've saved many millions of dollars for the general fund through Project Independence. You can get a latest update, and I'm quite sure Jacqueline knows that. So when we talk about surplus funds, I would hope you would possibly consider, if you're going to consider a minimum amendment, that's hard for me to say, a minimum amendment, that you also consider a dedication, possibly, into such things as helping the elderly remain in their home longer, because that has been documented as to what the cost savings are. Other than that, the 6% simple is just intended for just that purpose, so that people clearly understand it. We support Jacqueline and Department of Revenue's comments from our union's point of view, so appreciate the opportunity, and I hope I didn't take too long.
You did not, of course not. Mm-hmm. Questions or thoughts for the panel? I think y'all have done a good job of explaining the, and the department did, of explaining the difficulties with this bill, and so let us know the status of 2355. We might be interested if it's, I don't know, it's a House bill, so it's just assigned to a committee. And if you're having issues with it, I think this committee might be interested in taking a look at that issue if you do encounter problems.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else on House Bill 47, or Senate Bill 478? Close the public hearing, and we are adjourned. Thank you, committee.